Excision number 11940, reel 2.
Brigadier P.G. Jeffries, reel 2. Were you involved with the whole of the day with your platoon there, Brigadier?
Yes, you were involved very largely in most of the day. I didn't mention, when I was previously speaking, that the first thing after breakfast in the morning was company office. And any man who was on a charge was brought up in front of his company commander. And you, as platoon commander, would always stand beside him. You would be there. And you would answer for his conduct. The company commander knew it pretty well, but he'd get you to say it too. But I always remember that. And of course, later in the morning, there was regimental orders and commanding officer's orders. And again, a man in your platoon, you would go with him in front of the CO. And of course, the company commander would be there too. So you've got that little chore in addition.
What kind of disciplinary problems were cropping up at this time?
There was a certain amount of drunkenness. We, I must say, had fearfully little crime. But drunkenness was one of them. But it wasn't of serious proportions. There was a bit of drunkenness. And in those days, I suppose the same now probably, a man's conduct sheet, would record the number of cases of drunkenness that he'd had. And of course, I think his first case, he wouldn't get a fine. His second case, he got fined. His third case, he got fined more. And of course, according to the interval between those cases, it would be more serious. Of course, if it was a long interval, I think if it was a year, they'd all be washed out if he'd had drunk for a year. The other problem always with soldiers was VD, but that's not a crime, never was, except that a man who was being treated for VD lost his proficiency pay. I don't ever remember in the whole of my service a case of a soldier striking an officer. An NCO would be struck very occasionally, but it was a completely unusual thing. No, I suppose the chief things that you found at company office were having a dirty rifle on inspection, for having dirty boots on parade, those sort of minor things like that. And of course, if a good man came up with a thing like that, he would just get an admonishment. But you found, of course, that there were persistent chaps who failed in that thing. Well, you can remember, one can remember, you know, Private Smith, who'd be up once a week for having a dirty rifle, for no darn reason at all, except that he was just badly organized and idle. But there were awfully little of it. I mean, I would think that most company office mornings, there'd be hardly anybody up on a charge. There'd be some interviews, of course. There were a lot of good many interviews. If anybody wanted to make a complaint or have a family trouble to air and get advice on, that was the sort of thing that went on at company office. Company office, I would think, nearly always took half an hour.
Did you feel that were the punishments severe? Was there severe punishments for lack of discipline or failing in their duties?
You know, a man got CB, that's confined to barracks, and confined to barracks didn't only mean just being confined to barracks, it meant that he was on fatigues. After work, the bugle sounded for defaulters, and the defaulters ran to where the regimental police were, and then they went and scrubbed and peeled and all the rest of it. But detention, of course, being sent to a detention barracks was the greatest punishment. But only the commanding officer could give a sentence of detention, and the maximum that he could give, I think, was 12 days. But there was very little detention sentences, I remember, in the battalions before the war.
There wasn't anything which you would consider bordered on too tough, too harsh, too severe, brutality?
No. The modern cases of brutality and so forth that the press has made such a meal of in the last year or two never occurred in the regiment. I've never heard of such things happening. No, I don't think punishments were unduly severe at all.
We've talked about the men's food supplies and meals and so forth. Could you describe to me the workings and how the officers' mess was organised?
Yes, the officers' mess. There was also a sergeant's mess, you know, and a corporal's room, which acted in the same way, but on rather a more modest scale, naturally. The officers' mess in my regiment, the Durham Light Infantry, was comfortable, modest, and the food was dreadful, always. I never in the whole of my service before the war found the mess in the food in the officers' mess at all enjoyable. But it was served very genteelly. There was the officers' mess sergeant. There was the officers' mess corporal. And there'd be three or four waiters. And although you went up to the sideboard for your breakfast, helping, very often some of the more senior officers expected to be brought to them by a waiter. I always remember one of the more ancient majors in the regiment, who always said the same thing every morning when the waiter came to him and said, what for breakfast, sir? And he would reply, eggs and bacon. And the waiter would say, two eggs? And he would reply every morning to hoots of laughter, earn eggs, earn earth. No, the food was adequate, no doubt about that, which it wasn't always for the men. The food was adequate, but we paid a considerable amount into the funds for food. And goodness knows, it wasn't very good when we got it, but we got a bit more, of course, that way. You'd always have eggs and bacon for breakfast, a bit of porridge if you wanted it. You'd always have some meat or something like, and cheese for dinner, lunch. And then every single day of the week except Saturday and Sundays, You changed into mess kit, and you had mess dinner. And that usually consisted of some small thing to start off with, and a bit of meat, and possibly a bit of sweet. And the port was always passed around. In the Dharamite literature, there was very little heavy drinking, chiefly because none of us had any money. And if you wanted to take part in sports, if you wanted to go and shoot, or if you wanted to play polo, all your money went on that. And you couldn't afford to drink much. I drank fearfully little the whole of my pre-war time in the regiment, and so did all my contemporaries, and not many of the senior officers did either. The thing I think that be is rather a contrast to what goes on now is the number of us who were in the mess, because you weren't allowed to be married until you were 30. You got no marriage allowance, and so very few people did get married before they were 30. And as a result, you always had the mess full of people. I should think there were always 20 or 25 of us in the mess, which was it made for a very comradely business. And nobody ever was bad-tempered, if I remember. It was a very, very comradely, happy community, the Dharamite Infantry Officers' Mess.
Was the basic organisation of the mess retained right through the army career, including even in war zones? Did you try to retain the basic organisation of the mess?
Oh, no. Once you got into active service area, no, it went totally different. Officers fed with their companies, and they fed the men. They had the men's food. I think battalion headquarters always did a little bit better, but that was the system. Directly you got into the war zone.
What, I haven't asked you, Brigadier, what was the name of the camp that you were in Alexandria? Did you have a name?
It was called Mustafa Barracks. Yeah.
And how did you find the natives, the civilian population around you? Did you have any problems at all?
I don't really remember them, quite honestly. That, I think, you will find is a characteristic of the pre-war army. We were stationed all over the world. As a young officer, I started in Alexandria. I went to India. I was then in the Sudan, all before the war, in 10 years' service that I had before the war. And the whole of that time, one had no contact, really, with the local population. We made no friends amongst the natives. You had servants. People came and worked in the barracks, but of course you didn't have a private servant. You had your own batman who did that. So, and I think it was a disadvantage, really, that we didn't have much more contact with the locals. But after all, if you suddenly arrive in a station and you're there for 3 or 4 years, that's all. Difficult to get good contact and to make friends with a local population who itself would be pretty aloof. I mean, the higher up people in a community wouldn't be bothered with a transient population of soldiers, you see. That's about it.
What was the role of the batman to the officer?
Well, your batman became your friend, very much so. He had awfully little to do. He loved being batman because it was the idlest job you could possibly have. And he got a lot of perks. You paid him a bit extra. And he went and worked a bit in the officer's mess and, of course, got a bit extra grub there. But virtually all he did was to clean your equipment and get your clothes washed. I can't remember how that was done. There must have been some sort of laundry and so forth. In India, of course, there was a dhobi system, a wonderful system for washing clothes, which included the men's clothes as well. But I can't remember what went on in Alexander. My servant, Wilf Curtis, was such a nice man. I was very fond of Wilf. And he looked after me as a young officer when I started and kept my kit in goodish order. He took his discharge from the 1st Battalion, or just before the war, came back as a reservist, and was killed on the Esco at the very start of the war, Wilf Curtis, as a corporal then.
You've mentioned some of your duties, Brigadier. Can you describe to me the duties you perform as on guard duty?
Yes, guard duty was fairly routine. But in the morning, there was guard mounting. And the guard, if I remember right, in those pre-war days abroad, consisted of a sergeant, a corporal, and three men to every post. If you see the point, there'd be a sentry outside the guard room at the entrance to the barracks. So there would be three for that job. There would be other prowling jobs where you would have a sentry prowling the perimeter to see that thieves and so forth didn't get in. And you would probably have two prowlers going, I should think, based on a post. So you'd have three of them at each of those. So by and large, the guard would consist of this sergeant, corporal, and about a dozen men. And guard mounting was a tremendous game. The adjutant took this parade, and you had the old guard came out on parade, and the new guard came onto parade. And both were inspected by the adjutant. In addition, there was one extra man in the guard, and there was a bugler. Now, the extra man was the man selected as the best turned out, and he became the commanding officer's orderly for the day. So the adjutant went round the incoming guard and selected the stick man, as he was called. He was the best turned out man. And he didn't have to do any of the chores that the guard had to do, no sentry going or anything like that. All he had to do was to position himself smartly at battalion headquarters. He could sit in the clerk's room and that sort of thing, but if anything special was required, commanding officer's orderly would come out, and if the CO went round, he would always be accompanied by the commanding officer's orderly. And of course the bugler sounded all the calls, by which the whole life of a regiment in those days was organized. Then, after that part of the guard business had been done, the Earl Guard was marched off. And I think the New Guard certainly came to attention when the Earl Guard went off. I'm not sure it didn't present arms. I can't remember that. But anyway, there was a bit of ceremony about the Old Guard going off and the New Guard paying its compliments, and then the New Guard would march off to the guard room.
And as the Guard's officer, were you with them?
No, no. The adjutant then went back to his office. The guard was commanded by the sergeant of the guard. The orderly officer of the day visited the guard and all the sentries once by day and once by night. The guard room consisted of always a room with beds for the guards, where they slept when they were off duty, and where they fed. And then some cells with chains and keys. And that's where any man who committed a violent crime or was drunk was put in. But it was only exceptional for a man to be put in the guardroom.
Were there any other duties as a young officer that you had to do? Any other duties that stand out in your memory?
Not really. You'd be on a court-martial occasionally. I think I attended about three in my service. But I don't really remember any special duties that are worth mentioning.
Can I ask your memories on your officers of that time, your CO and your adjutant and so on? Do you know the names of them? Do you recall
Yes.
their names? And
the 1st Battalion, when I joined, was commanded by Colonel Claude Matthews, who had been a great friend of my father, incidentally. They both joined the Durham Regiment on the same day. He was a most popular, nice, excellent soldier. Very well liked throughout the battalion. Loved, even. I remember him. He was a most exceptional chap. I don't think he got on with his brigadier and the generals above him. He was totally outspoken and felt that the battalion was much better than any battalion that they'd had anything to do with. And so he'd better not be too critical. That sort of thing. He was a wonderful chap, Colonel Claude Matthews. The adjutant was Bobby Simpson. And Bobby, at that time, in 1929, was still a subaltern. And he had 10 years' service. Such was the speed of promotion in those days. He was a tremendous athlete, a great golf player, wonderful tennis player, good football player, first-class rugby player, very high-class rugby player, played I don't think he played for the army in England, but I'm not sure, but he'd be right up in that class. He got command of the 2nd Battalion on the outbreak of war, and commanded it through the retreat from the Belgian frontier, and was wounded on the Donge, I think, and taken prisoner. And that was the end of Bobby's career. A wonderfully good companion and a splendid officer, and the best adjutant I should think anybody could possibly have. He was absolutely first class.
Are there any other officers that come to mind?
Yes, Jock Hastid, my company commander. Jock won a DSO in the First War as a, I suppose, either as a subaltern or a captain. He was a great sportsman and a very clever, erudite man. Ideal for a young officer to have as company commander. He was also a wonderful fisherman, trout fisherman. And when we were in the Sudan later, he was our CO, and I remember him, he took a party, I should think once a fortnight, up the Nile, and we had a tremendous fishing expedition up there after the Nile perch. He was a great man, Jock Hastid. Another company commander, Dad Heslop. Dad became commanded, he'd been in the First War, of course, and when the Second War started, he got command of a tank battalion, I remember, and I have quite a distinguished career, Dad Heslop.
About any NCOs, do you recall any of those from this period of time?
I can recollect my platoon sergeant, Sergeant Hatton. He was a regimental heavyweight boxer. He was a tremendous boxer, Hatton. He was pretty hard on the men, I think. But a good chap. I can't remember. Yes, Goddard was the regimental sergeant major, but I don't remember him very well. Stupidly, I can't remember company sergeant major. I remember his name. I remember him terribly well. Mind you, it's 50 years ago, whatever it was. But he was very good, our company sergeant major, and the colour sergeant.
What was the background of the soldiers that you had, the other ranks? What was their background?
Well, of the men.